A few weeks ago, you met filmmaker Sarah Feinbloom, who explored the faith journey of six American adolescents across two decades. This week, we're taking a look at the next generation, the so-called Generation Z, born between 1997 and 2012, and their relationship with religion during a time of unprecedented upheaval in our culture and society. Now, we can do this thanks to the largest survey of this population on issues of faith just published by Springtide Research Institute, and I am joined right now by Institute Executive Director Dr. Josh Packard. Josh, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Whom and when did you survey for this report?
Yeah, it's a really key question to understand. So at Springtide, we're always collecting data of 13 to 25-year-olds, primarily at the intersection of their, what we call their inner and outer lives, their faith lives and their daily lives across all different religious contexts and no religious context, as is increasingly the case for lots of young people. So the data for this State of Religion in Young People 2020 report on relational authority was collected from late 2019 all the way up to late summer of 2020. And we ended up surveying a nationally representative sample of about just about 10,000 young people. And then we did over 150 qualitative interviews, in-depth interviews with 13 to 25-year-olds as well to help us. You know, those two kinds of research tell you different things. The surveys tell you what is happening, and the interviews help you get to get an understanding of how something happens or why people are making certain decisions.
Give us, if you will, some of the top line findings that are highlights of what you found.
We try and summarize, you know, for as well as sort of put together in a novel way around this relational authority framework of like what we see is happening with young people and belief throughout the year. And chief among those, the biggest takeaway for people to understand is that the old categories of affiliation and disaffiliation, they just don't mean what they used to. They used to be, I think, really good indicators. Like if a young person said they were, you know, Christian Catholic or Christian Protestant or Jewish or Muslim or whatever they checked the box of, that used to mean, you know, we could assume a certain amount of things about their identity and their beliefs and their practices that followed from that. And we can't make those assumptions now. To give you just one example, if we look at just the young people who said that they were affiliated with a specific faith tradition, well, over half of those affiliated young people, 52%, told us that they don't trust organized religion. So even the people who are claiming affiliation don't necessarily trust the institution that that you might work for if you're a faith leader. And that complication, it runs throughout. It's the same for disaffiliated young people. Disaffiliated young people used to reasonably assume that if a young person wasn't affiliated with any faith tradition, that they were probably not even interested in the conversation. And what the data tell us here is that pretty overwhelmingly, they're still very interested in, you know, not only conversations, but actual activities and beliefs around God. A lot of them still attend religious services on a fairly regular basis. So that would be the biggest takeaway finding, is that we need new understanding of what young people's faith lives actually look like. And I think when we start really digging in, what we see is a pretty altered map, and in some ways a very expanded playing field for who is actually open to the conversation that religious leaders might want to have with young people.
What were the biggest surprises for you in the results that you saw?
Well, I was really surprised at how articulate young people were in terms of their ability to express exactly what it was that they wanted from the adults in their lives. You know, I think generations are really the sort of last place where it's okay to stereotype people. I often say that they are, speaking about generations is often just a container for bias. We get to bring all of our biases to those in some legitimate way. And young people kept turning that on its head and turning it inside out in a lot of ways. So rather than being disinterested or apathetic, we found young people consistently interested in religious conversations, and they wanted adults who, you know, weren't just condoning of every opinion or thought or idea or even behavior that they had, but In fact, what they told us all the time, the way they would say it is, we don't want adults to be our friends. We want them to be our coaches and guides and mentors, which I thought was just a really astute way of putting it. And so that was probably the most consistently surprising thing for me.
As often as the disconnect between young Americans and organized religion get bemoaned, I'm stunned by the percentage of respondents you say have been contacted by a faith leader during this lengthy pandemic. Talk about that number, if you would.
Yeah, that's a really important number to point out. We did the study in the very early days of the pandemic, and 1% of young people that said a faith leader had reached out to them. And I think, you know, what this, for me, this is a part of the story this doesn't say anything about faith leaders' desires. It says more about like what sort of groundwork and foundation that we've been laying for our interactions with young people. And they've been primarily driven through these really programmatic, physical place-based kinds of things. In other words, like come to our congregation in whatever expression or form that takes, and that's where we engage with you. And then the pandemic comes along and disrupts the ability to do that. And I think what a lot of people found, sort of a rude awakening, was that when the ability to meet in a physical place went away, their ability to impact young people went away. And that really brings to question of like, what are you actually doing? Some places have been able to pivot since then, but frankly, it hasn't been, at least what I'm hearing anecdotally, is that it hasn't been entirely encouraging. We're currently doing focus groups with religious leaders who work with young people. We've been doing it for the last 6 months. We've had hundreds of people in these focus groups right now up to this point. And we know the intentions and the good hearts and how hard religious leaders, faith leaders are working to try and bridge this gap. And we also do a lot of, obviously, we collect a lot of data from young people, and we know how much young people really want adults in their lives. And at Springtide, we're really trying to bring some frameworks together that can help bridge that gap. Because right now, I think often the institutions are stuck in these sort of program-driven models that were really effective for a very long time, but the world has changed. And just like Blockbuster isn't an effective way to rent and see movies anymore, you know, we need to rethink some of the ways that we do programs or youth ministry, religious education in this new world.
Ultimately, if I understand it, you found the pandemic to have strengthened the faith of a significant number of survey respondents. I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, certainly that was the case early on. We're going to do a follow-up study here that'll go out in January to be sort of January, February, to be sort of 1 year in. And I'll be really curious to see what that, you know, if those were durable findings over the course of the year. But I think more than anything, what it highlighted is sort of in the early days of the lockdowns that came along with the pandemic and the loneliness and isolation began to set in, what you saw were young people sort of turning to religious and faith practices, some of which they may have been familiar with, some of which may have been brand new to them, at an increasing rate. And that was coming, though, with this 1% number of, like, you know, young people were sort of doing this without really good guides, like right at a time when they needed the experts to help them figure that stuff out. The experts were nowhere to be found that they could find. And so I'm curious about then the impact of not having those people who are, you know, so well versed in how to maintain healthy spiritual and faith practices. If those haven't been able to come alongside young people over the last year, I'm afraid that most of those probably would have been short-lived, even if the interest initially was really high.
Do you have material data that go way back so that you have something to look at in the past as you can put these two together and see what changes have happened?
Well, certainly Springtide is asking some questions that nobody's ever asked before, because we have a different understanding and set of assumptions about young people's religious behavior especially as it happens outside of institutions increasingly. But that being said, I'm a trained PhD in sociology, have been a professor for a long time. We rely on a lot of standardized scales and measures from a variety of studies. So we use the UCLA Loneliness Index, which is a pretty standard measure of loneliness. We try to word our questions on our surveys to match up with Pew and Gallup and the General Social Survey and other places so that we can do that kind of comparison, even though, there's a difference here in that we have to cut our data differently because at Springtide, we think it's really important to spend the extra time and money and resources to go all the way down to 13-year-olds. And most of those surveys will stop at 18. So we can only, sort of look at those same, you got to compare apples to apples, but so for a lot of the stuff we're doing, we are able to look at trends over time, even though we're new.
I'm just really interested in the loneliness that you're talking about because that word comes up so often. Do you think the word lonely is a part of where we are in this pandemic?
The data that we collected for belonging was collected before the pandemic started or was even, known to be a thing. And in fact, our interest in loneliness and belonging came from a study that Cigna, the big health conglomerate, had done that showed that for the first time since we've been tracking this, so 40 or 50 years, that the youngest generation is the loneliest generation on record. It's almost always the oldest generation that ranks at the highest end of this, whenever social scientists administer the scale, for reasons that you can probably guess. But it's really the data are conclusive and overwhelming that it's the youngest generation now. And it's really counterintuitive because we think of young people as being so connected on their devices all the time. And what the story that's under that story that turns out to be the case is that, yes, young people they're hyper-networked. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're very connected to each other or that they're deriving a great sense of belonging from those relationships. And, I think it's an example of where, if you're only asking one set of questions or if you're just looking at a piece of data without the context around it, it could lead you to a false set of assumptions about what's really going on, which ultimately impacts your actions in ways that might lead you to say, well, young people are unreachable. They're always on their devices. They don't need me anyway. And that's just not true.
Explain, if you would, the term relational authority.
This is the sort of concept or framework that emerged to us from the data. That as we started putting the pieces together in terms of, okay, so, what is effective in reaching young people in 2020? If young people don't feel connected to programs simply by attendance, we felt like it was maybe a bit of an oversimplification to say, well, you just need to have more relationships with young people. I mean, yes, it's true, but what do those relationships need to look like or consist of? And what we found is that it's a particular kind of relationship that really infuses trust between you and a young person. And that we sifted through a lot of different, we asked a lot of questions to really distill down to these five elements of relational authority. And this emerged as sort of, the theme for the year because, man, I just can't think of anything, more important than being in a really trusted relationship with a young person right now if you're an adult looking to have an impact in their lives. And it was interesting to us that like four of them are sort of grouped in this dimension and these what I would call this like almost these friendship dimensions. So listening, transparency, integrity, and care. So there's these very interpersonal, touchy-feely kind of dimensions. And we operationalize, or rather we explain what each of those mean so that you can do them effectively if you're interested. But those four don't matter if you're only doing those four. You have to couple them with this fifth element of expertise that to really have an impact in the life of young people. It's not enough to be an expert alone. Young people don't trust experts. I wish they did. Like I said, I have a PhD and I've taught college classes. I wish my students just trusted me because I had a fancy title. But they, they told us the data are overwhelming that if you don't couple your expertise with those other four dimensions of relationship, then they're going to be distrustful of you. They're not going to think that you're using your expertise to benefit them. They're going to naturally assume from the jump that you are doing it to benefit you or the institution that you serve. And that is a dramatic change from where we were maybe even 20 or 25 years ago.
Is there anything that you want to highlight that we haven't talked about because I don't want us to leave something out?
Yeah, it's a great question. At Springtide, all of our prescriptive elements, so anytime that we're using the word should, they're going to be rooted in the best behavioral and social science that we can find. The nice thing here is that you can take comfort that we're not being driven by a particular ideological agenda, but also, and I think, just as important, if not more importantly here, it means that people who are reading this report can bring their own agendas to it. You know, so if you're coming at this from a Christian perspective and you want to, you know, the New Testament fits right in line here with relational authority. You can be a relational authority in the life of a young person, while preaching the gospel. If you are interested in passing along the Jewish tradition to young people, same thing. The relational authority framework works, and it can help you to sort of convey the long history of the rituals and beliefs of the Jewish tradition, and on and on and on. And I think it also works if you're, you know, working in an after-school program, and what you really want to do is create great relationships, not in a faith-based perspective. I don't think it works. I'm not trying to say it's the one-size-fits-all solution for everything in all places, but I think the utility here is pretty broad, because mostly what young people are interested in is finding trusted adults that they can have conversations with.
Springtide Research Institute has just released its comprehensive survey, The State of Religion in Young People 2020, Relational Authority. You can read the full report at springtideresearch.org. Josh, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. We'd love to hear from any of your listeners who engage with the report. We're happy to hear from them.